This is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the September 23rd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners, to get your takes on the world. And since next Wednesday will be one of those fifth Wednesdays, I'll be right back here on September 30th again to get your takes on the world. Yesterday, two of the world's most formidable figures, Chinese President Xi Jinping and Pope Francis, arrived in Washington on state visits. Happily for those in charge of White House protocol, the visit of the Chinese president began in Seattle, in the other Washington, 2,800 miles away. The distance is apt, since both men could not be further apart. Yet there is a significant segment of the nation's political class, named the Republican Party, which will not be holding out the welcome mat for either one. Only Pope Francis, however, has been invited to address a joint session of Congress, where the reception for the head of the Catholic Church on Thursday is not expected to be as friendly as the one accorded to Benjamin Netanyahu, the head of the Israeli state, this past March, which drew 49 standing ovations. The last thing we would anticipate from our elected representatives would be thunderous applause for a man who insists on preaching to the world about the heartlessness of unbridled capitalism, of our throwaway consumer culture, and the need to confront climate change. His opposition to abortion and same-sex marriage won't change that. You can hear the Pope's speech to Congress tomorrow morning right here on KZYX, with coverage beginning at 7 a.m. The arrival of Xi Jinping and the 3 days he is spending in Seattle meeting with major U.S. high-tech leaders before continuing on to the nation's capital and a rendezvous with President Obama dovetails into what we will be talking about later in the program with Professor Albert McCoy. Professor McCoy has just written a paper that rejects the widely stated belief frequently voiced by his Republican critics that Obama is clueless when it comes to foreign policy. In his new article, quote, "Grandmaster of the Great Game, Obama's Geopolitical Strategy for Containing China," McCoy argues that, quote, "in ways that have eluded Washington's pundits and policymakers, President Barack Obama is deploying a subtle geopolitical strategy that, if successful, might give Washington a fighting chance to extend its global hegemony deep into the 21st century. After 6 years of silent, sometimes secret preparations," he writes, "the Obama White House has recently unveiled some bold diplomatic initiatives whose sum is nothing less than a tricontinental strategy to check Beijing's rise. As these moves unfold," McCoy continues, "Obama is revealing himself as one of the rare grandmasters who appear every generation or two with an ability to go beyond mere foreign policy and play that ruthless global game called geopolitics," end quote. That's from Professor Alfred McCoy, who I'll be engaging in conversation about the subject at about 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned. In the meantime, let's look at some other issues that have been in the news. The first, of course, is what appears to be the end of a contest in Congress between the president and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the agreement negotiated between Iran and the 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council, plus Germany, to severely curtail Iran's nuclear enrichment program for the next 15 years. I venture to say and suspect most pundits would agree that were he eligible, Netanyahu would easily be the choice of the Republicans as their nominee for president in 2016. Yes, I know, given the caliber of their current stable of wannabes, that isn't saying much. But their failure to win over enough Democrats to vote with them to override Obama's threatened veto, or even enough to prevent the Democrats' so-called filibuster that kept a vote on the agreement from coming to the Senate floor, is being portrayed widely as a major defeat for AIPAC, Israel's lobby in Washington. Israel's premier lobbying group reportedly spent at least $40 million in national advertising designed to pressure Senate Democrats to express their opposition to the Iran agreement, and it didn't work. It didn't work because lawmakers were made aware that while AIPAC and the major Jewish organizations and think tanks were united in their opposition to the Iran agreement, the majority of American Jews and a significant number of former Jewish community leaders, including a former head of AIPAC, supported it. Plus, a relatively new Jewish lobbying organization, J Street, which was founded in 2008, had described itself as pro-peace, pro-Israel, and by others as AIPAC Lite, also favored the agreement, and this gave Democratic politicians a cover for defying an AIPAC directive, an act that in other circumstances would be characterized as political suicide. It's hard to exaggerate the damage inflicted on AIPAC by the congressional defeat of its efforts to torpedo the Iran nuclear deal, wrote former AIPAC staff member M.J. Rosenberg of The Nation. It's not as if AIPAC won't live to fight again, because it will. But this defeat has ruptured the status quo, possibly forever. End quote. Referring to how AIPAC has historically operated, Rosenberg recalled, quote, as one congressional staffer put it to me, taking money from AIPAC is like getting a loan from the mob. You better not forget to pay it back. They walk into this office like they own it. Rosenberg himself had worked for years on the Hill, and in a talk I played on Takes on the World in May, he described how AIPAC would write a bill and then take it over to an Israeli-friendly member of Congress on the appropriate committee and have them put their name on it as a sponsor. The effort hasn't been a total failure, notes Foreign Policy's Bill Allison. AIPAC has seen the numbers of Americans who disapprove of the deal increase, while it has raised more money so far in 2015 than in any previous year, and that's not unprecedented. AIPAC's other losing battles with the White House have led to bigger donations from its members. AIPAC's fundraising increased substantially after it unsuccessfully battled the Reagan administration's 1981 sale of AIPAC AWACS surveillance aircraft to Saudi Arabia, and 10 years later when President George Herbert Walker Bush's conditioned Israel's demand for $10 billion in loan guarantees on an ending settlement construction in the West Bank, which Israel's then Prime Minister Itzhak Shamir refused to do. According to an article on the right-wing Town Hall website, the real test for AIPAC is whether it will, quote, take up arms against the incumbents who voted for the deal, end quote. And it goes on, many think that the members of Congress who voted for it did so because they believed they could do so with impunity, said the Town Hall article. We will soon see how real the strength of AIPAC is, especially with its enemies out for blood, it noted. If they don't punish someone for their vote supporting the Iran deal, they risk being seen as a paper tiger, where there are no consequences if you cross them, especially on such a visible policy fight on which they took such a staunch stand. This could be a make-or-break-it time for AIPAC. End quote. At this point in discussing AIPAC's future, it would be do well to recall what the late Chinese leader Zhou Enlai replied when asked his opinion about the French Revolution. It's too early to tell, he said. Well, what has been reported is that to mend the Israel-U.S. relations that may have been bruised by the Iran deal, the president will be offering to raise the current $30 billion-plus 10-year arms package to Israel by $15 billion to $45 billion. This presumably will allow them to put their hands on more F-35 stealth jets, if they choose, more than anticipated, at absolutely no cost to Israel's taxpayers. And conceivably, as some Democrats who voted for the deal had suggested, like Cory Booker, the bunker busters and the aircraft to carry them that would be necessary to destroy Iran's underground nuclear facilities. That certainly is an achievement that will be claimed by AIPAC, and if Republicans maintain control of both the Senate and the House and win the presidency in 2016, AIPAC will be more powerful than ever. But wait, it may be even worse than that. According to the Associated Press, Vice President Joe Biden, a self-declared proud Zionist and a possible contender for the Democratic presidential candidacy, told a group of Jewish leaders 2 weeks ago that the U.S. had committed to Israel's protection, that Israel's commitment to Israel's protection is infallible, in that the U.S. has committed to provide more than $7.18 billion in security aid over the next year. The story was reported on ABC and several newspapers around the country, but not in the New York Times, not in the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal, or on NPR. There's another related story, almost local, that I'm going to throw in here. It took place in Berkeley last Wednesday when City Councilman Daryl Moore fired his appointee on the city's Human Welfare and Community Action Commission, Cheryl Davila, who is African-American, for refusing to withdraw a proposal for the city to divest from companies complicit in human rights abuses in the occupied Palestinian territories. Davila, a commissioner since 2009, described feeling appalled by what she saw in Gaza last summer, quote, "The Israeli bombardment was a disgraceful human rights violation that has caused a severe social welfare crisis, particularly for children, women, and the elderly in Gaza." Given that Berkeley, she says, was one of the first municipalities to pass an anti-apartheid resolution, Berkeley to do the same for Palestinians who are living under an apartheid regime. "We could not be silent any longer," end quote. Her resolution also called for the city to add Israel's military regime to the West Bank, to Israel, to Berkeley's oppressive states list, which restricts city purchases from oppressive regimes, including that of the Tibet Autonomous Region. At the Wednesday meeting, the commission took up the resolution in front of a standing-room-only crowd of supporters. As she arrived, Davila was told that she had been terminated. Speaking to the commissioners from the audience, she said, quote, "Councilman Moore called me yesterday morning and told me that if I would not withdraw this resolution, he would remove me from the commission. I told him that I feel passionately about this issue and I urge you to pass it today," end quote. Scores of speakers urged the commission to respect Davila's wishes and send the recommendation on to the city council. In the end, commissioners voted to impanel a subcommittee to revise the resolution, committing to vote again at their next meeting in October. In truth, despite its radical history from the free speech movement through the Vietnam War and People's Park, Berkeley has long been Israeli-occupied territory. In 1984, a proposition was put on the Berkeley ballot calling for the U.S. to withhold aid from Israel in the amount it was spending on building settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. Cynically embracing the slogan, "Because we want peace," and using a photo of the Vietnam Wall as a backdrop and another of an anti-war protest, the local pro-Israel organizations produced a slick mailer with quotes from Senator Alan Cranston and Barbara Boxer endorsing the same theme. On election day, Berkeley's liberals rose as one to defeat the proposition, with Congressman Ron Dellums not only refusing to take a position on the measure, but suggesting that putting such issues on the ballot was unwise. It was defeated by a 2-1 vote. In 1988, another proposition made the Berkeley ballot, which would have had it become a sister city with a Palestinian refugee camp of Jabalia in Gaza, as it had with Soweto in apartheid South Africa. But that was also too much for Berkeley's liberals, who, as they had done for 4 years earlier, went up and down the state to get the names of Democratic politicians to oppose it. Berkeley Mayor Gus Newport was the only African-American politician with a guts to support it. Greatly outspent, it also went down to defeat. In the same year, 1988, a proposition made to the San Francisco ballot calling for a two-state solution. It also went down to defeat after leading the polls, thanks partially to the campaign's leadership being taken over from the Arab Americans who had initiated it by the head of the Middle East desk of the American Friends Service Committee and members of New Jewish Agenda. These activists insisted that those speaking on behalf of the measure not mention Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's orders to break the hands of young Palestinian stone throwers, that they not speak about USAID to Israel, nor so much as whisper about the Israel lobby or the money that was coming from all over the country from supporters of Israel to defeat the bill. They would later call that taking the high road. Yet it ultimately took a number of very fancy mailers invoking images of Martin Luther King, the United Nations, Harvey Milk, and Costa Rican President Oscar Arias, without his permission, to defeat the measure, again, in the name of peace. The tragedy of the refugees from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, sub-Saharan Africa continues, and yet it hasn't seemed to dawn on Americans or the elected officials that the major responsibility for the sad affairs across that vast area lay at the door of the United States and those responsible for launching the war in Iraq. That deposing the secular bulwark against Saudi-funded jihadism would destabilize the region was foreseen, at least, by George Bush Sr., who, after Iraqi troops from Kuwait, enraged the neocons and led to the founding of the Project for New American Century, the first goal of which was to oust Saddam. That was followed by the overthrowing of the Gaddafi regime in Libya, who also, it turned out, was keeping the country's jihadists in check, and that left Bashar Assad as the only secular leader in the region. By 2006, 5 years before the so-called Arab Spring, and well before the first peaceful protests against the Assad regime, a cable was sent by a U.S. official named Roebuck from the U.S. Embassy in Damascus, and later released by WikiLeaks, suggesting that Islamic jihadists be supported within Syria to put pressure on the Assad regime, which was obvious code for regime change. It was Afghanistan 1979 redux, except this time the arms came from Gaddafi's armories, their contents made available to jihadists after his death, many of whom went off to Syria to fight the regime and join al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, and eventually Daesh or ISIS. Arms and money, lots of it came as well from the Saudis, from Qatar, from all the Gulf sheikdoms that have long sought to eliminate any presence of secularism in the region, no matter how corrupt it was. Some of the Libyan weapons also went to Boko Haram in Nigeria, which enabled it to raise its political profile as well as its kill count. But it all started in Washington with the plans by the neocons to reverse America's long-standing approach to the oil-rich Middle East, substituting chaos for the stability that assured the flow of oil to the U.S. and its allies around the world. Engaging in wars of conquest there was not on the U.S. agenda, but eliminating Israel's enemies in the region topped the neocon menu, beginning with Saddam. And so when they were given top post in the G.W. Bush administration, the evidence to justify the war was manufactured, as it was to justify the sanctions that continue on Iran. But one can look far and wide in the U.S. today without discovering any sense of responsibility for the present Middle East turmoil and the refugee flow. Now, seizing the opportunity, Vladimir Putin has raised Russia's profile in the region, engaging all the players, not only flirting with but trading with America's allies, to the point that Washington and its NATO allies don't quite know how to respond to the movement of Russian forces into Western Syria, both to join the fight against the Islamic State and to shore up the government of Bashar Assad. Russia's enlarged presence in Syria so upset Israel's Netanyahu that he rushed off to Moscow to get Putin's assurance that Russia will not provide arms to Hezbollah. On several occasions during Syria's ongoing conflict, Israeli jets have attacked and destroyed Syrian truck convoys, which they claim were carrying weapons for Hezbollah. While the Syrians have never attempted to retaliate, it's unlikely the Russians would turn the other cheek. Russian forces appear to be expanding their military presence in Syria through the development of two additional bases, according to new satellite imagery viewed by the Wall Street Journal. According to that paper, the expansion near the Mediterranean coast is the latest sign Russia is preparing to inject its military forces into the country's four-and-a-half-year war. This creates new problems for the U.S.-led coalition trying to force President Bashar al-Assad from power and defeat Islamic State militants. Until recently, the Russian buildup in Syria was largely focused on an air base south of the port city of Latakia, but he has now shipped more than 24 combat aircraft to the airfield where Russian surveillance drones have started flying, according to U.S. defense officials. U.S. officials have both criticized Russia for the military buildup and at the same time are trying to find an accommodation with it. Secretary of State John Kerry has taken the lead in pressing Moscow to play a constructive role in Syria, while Defense Secretary Ash Carter has launched a preliminary talk meant to ensure that American and Russian forces don't clash in the skies above Syria. Russia has strategic interests in Syria, since its only Mediterranean naval base is the port city of Tartus, about 60 miles south of Latakia. Unlike his Western counterparts, Russia's Putin has not been accused of either arming or training jihadist groups, while the same cannot be said for either Britain or the United States. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.